I was asked to update the current status of constraints on neutrino flavors. I've taken sort of a broader point of view. One of the purposes, at least that I have in mind for this talk, is to let all of you know what my interests are. So while we're here, there may be overlapping interests and issues that many of us can usefully discuss. So basically, I want to show that by combining constraints on neutrinos, which is really a way of saying the relativistic energy density in the universe. So anything that might change the relativistic energy density, extra neutrinos or some other particles, or maybe modified physics coming from higher dimensional theories, will affect the expansion rate of the universe around the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and also around the time that the CMB is formed, that is the anisotropy spectrum, the fluctuations in the background temperature. And so combining these two, which occur at vastly different epochs in the evolution of the universe, we can have constraints on the relativistic content of the universe. I think by now, most people, by osmosis, know the general outline of BBN, so I'll just say a few words about it. The abundances of the light nuclei up through lithium are formed in the first 20 minutes or so of the evolution of the universe, because when the universe was roughly between 1 and 1,000 seconds old, the temperature and the density were such that nuclear reactions occurred. But of course, the universe is expanding and cooling. And very quickly, the universal nuclear reactor ran out of energy and temperature and density. And so these reactions stopped before the gap at mass 8 could be bridged. And as a result, it's only the light nuclei that are formed. Of course, hydrogen, heavy hydrogen, light and heavy helium, and lithium-7 mainly. Lithium-6 is about two orders of magnitude in abundance below lithium-7, which, as you'll see, is already very low in abundance. I put beryllium-7 here because there are two paths to making mass-7. Helium-3 alpha-gamma reactions and tritium alpha-gamma reactions. And so you can make lithium-7 or beryllium-7. Lithium-7 can be destroyed very easily by reactions with protons. And as a result, it'll turn out that for the baryon density range of current interest to us, most of the lithium-7 that we see today, or that we infer from old objects in the universe, was actually made as beryllium-7, which later captured an electron and beta decayed to lithium-7. And for the nuclear physicists in the audience, I want to say now, because I may forget later, is that there may be a problem with the lithium, a primordial lithium abundance. And it's a problem that I don't think can be resolved by changing the relativistic energy density, by neutrino asymmetry, and maybe it has something to do with those cross-sections. I'd be glad to talk with anyone who has an interest in that offline. For these nuclei, the abundances are rate limited. That is, it's a competition between production, destruction, and the expansion rate of the universe. And as a result, the abundances of these elements are sensitive to the reaction rates and therefore to the nucleon density. Now, of course, as the universe expands, the nucleon density is always changing. So it's useful to compare the number of nucleons in a co-moving volume to the number of photons in a co-moving volume. Because after E plus E minus annihilation in the universe, that ratio hardly ever changes, hardly changes at all. And in fact, we can account for those changes if we're interested. So this parameter eta is the useful parameter, the ratio of nucleons to photons in the universe. In terms, especially of the CMB analyses, the parameter of choice is omega in baryons, that is the ratio to the critical density of the mass density in baryons times the square of the Hubble parameter, where little h is the Hubble parameter in units of 100 in astronomers' units. Little h is very close to 0.7, so h squared is about a half, so you can do the arithmetic easily in your head if you're interested in making this conversion. I'll often use this parameter eta sub 10 because this ratio of nucleons to photons is very small. In fact, approaching maybe 10 to the minus 9, and as a result, this parameter eta sub 10 is between 1 and 10. In contrast to deuterium, helium-3, lithium-7, or beryllium-7, the helium-4, the alpha particle abundance, or in astronomers' favorite units, the mass fraction in helium-4, capital Y, is in fact not rate limited. Once the nuclear reactions begin, they go very rapidly. The most tightly bound light nucleus is the alpha particle, and there's a gap at mass 5. And so you can't just add a neutron or a proton to jump that gap. You have to have reactions with deuterons, helium-3, tritium. They're low in abundance, and some of them have a higher Coulomb charge, which inhibits the reactions. And as a result, most of the neutrons that were available at the time of when nucleosynthesis began are incorporated in the alpha particle. And therefore, it's not the nuclear reaction rates that count, it's the neutron to proton ratio that limits the helium abundance. Now, the helium abundance, therefore, is sensitive to the competition between the weak interaction rate, maybe normalized by the neutron lifetime, and the expansion rate of the universe. Let me introduce some notation here. The expansion rate parameter, S, is the ratio of the Hubble parameter, the expansion rate, in a modified cosmology compared to the standard value, that is with three light neutrinos and all the rest of the standard particles in the particle zoo. So one way of parameterizing this expansion rate parameter, the ratio of the Hubble parameter, which in the absence of changing the strength of gravity is just the square root of the ratio of the new density to the standard density, is by the extra number of neutrinos. But this is just the parameterization for all we're concerned with. That is, it doesn't have to be extra neutrinos. It's anything that changes the standard expansion rate. Let me at this point, I was actually going to show it later, but I think this might be a good point to illustrate one of the pitfalls. I said it's the competition between the expansion rate and the weak interaction rate, as normalized, for example, by the neutron lifetime. I've taken this from the particle data group. They have a summary of the neutron lifetime that they adopted as a function of the publication date. And what I want to illustrate here is that systematic errors obviously dominated the determination of the neutron lifetime, and therefore quoting sigmas, which we'll be doing with abundances, doesn't always mean that you can't expect very big changes due to systematic effects.
Can you extrapolate that back to
the neutron was stable.
I was going to ask you to extrapolate back to Chapman. Do you know the lifetime? I'm surprised that your axis started in 1960.
Well, that's the particle data group summaries. I don't know when the first determination was. I don't know. I don't think Chadwick knew. It's very hard, obviously. You've got to keep those neutrons around, don't let them hit the walls and so on. So I think it was low temperature or very cooled neutron experiments that were required. So here is a picture which I think many of you have seen, that is, what is the prediction of the standard hot Big Bang model for the abundances. So I've got an abundance scale that goes from 100% down to a part in 10 to the 10 or a little bit lower, and this parameter eta basically between 1 and 10. The helium abundance, as you can see, is extremely insensitive to the nucleon abundance. This actually, the thickness of this curve is the uncertainty due to the any of the uncertainties in the nuclear reaction rates, but dominated by the neutron lifetime uncertainty, which is less than 1 second out of about 886 seconds. Here's the predicted deuterium abundance by number with respect to hydrogen, helium 3, and mass 7, even though I've called it lithium 7. And the bands represent an estimate of the uncertainty due to the basically the nuclear physics uncertainties. In fact, there have been some reanalyses of the nuclear physics experiments, one by the group at Chicago, Burles, Nollet, and Turner, and a group in France, which basically have reduced for deuterium and helium-3 and even for lithium-7, the width of this band by factors of 2 to 3. But this is an analysis with older uncertainties for the nuclear reactions that we've done at Ohio State, so that's what I'm showing here. This valley shape for mass 7 is on the low eta end, you're mostly producing lithium-7. As the baryon density increases, you destroy it, and then the beryllium-7 chain becomes more important, and as you increase the baryon density, you're making more and more beryllium-7. Eventually, this too will turn over. You'll destroy the beryllium-7, but at a much higher density. So, if I know the abundance of any one of these elements, let's say deuterium, I can then predict the expected abundance of helium, helium-3, lithium-7. As I'll show you, it's the deuterium abundance which first of all has the strongest sensitivity to the baryon to photon ratio, and in some sense would be the cleanest element to consider, because deuterium, being so weakly bound, is only destroyed after the Big Bang. That is, any material incorporated in the star, before the star has reached the main sequence, when it's fully convective and mixed, it gets hot enough to burn deuterium to helium-3. And so any deuterium that went into a star is destroyed. So the deuterium that we see, for example, in the interstellar gas today in our galaxy, or in high redshift absorbing clouds, provides at least a bound to the primordial abundance. The primordial abundance can only be higher. There are no sources of deuterium. There are places where deuterium is made, but by and large it's then processed and destroyed before it gets out of the star. Or, along with deuterium, you make lithium, and since the predicted primordial abundances differ by five or more orders of magnitude, any stellar processes which produce significant amounts of lithium-7 would grossly overproduce deuterium. Okay, so for example, we can illustrate the fact that it was the expansion rate or the number of neutrinos that influences most strongly the helium abundance. So what I've done now is I've done a version of that previous transparency, but with three different neutrino numbers, or three different early universe expansion rates. Two neutrinos, three neutrinos, four neutrinos. As I mentioned, currently we think the neutron lifetime is extremely well known. And so what I've plotted is the predicted helium abundance versus the predicted deuterium abundance. So if you measure the deuterium abundance and you measure the helium abundance, you can determine which of these is closest to the data. And I'll show you later the same transparency with a data point on it, and we'll see what the consequences are. But notice that given sufficient accuracy in the helium abundance determination, we should be able to separate two from three neutrinos, or whether three neutrinos is the best fit, or something with a slower expansion rate than standard might be a better fit. Okay, well, I can't, I don't have time. I'd love to talk forever, but I don't have time to talk about all of the abundances, so let me concentrate on deuterium because I think it is the baryometer of choice. As I mentioned already, deuterium is only destroyed in stars. So when you observe it anywhere, anytime, if you make a deuterium abundance determination which isn't overwhelmed by systematic errors, then whatever you determine anywhere, anytime, is less than or equal to what the primordial value is. And in particular, since the way you destroy deuterium is by cycling it through stars, if you go to environments which have had very little stellar processing, either because you go back in time to epochs younger than the present age of the universe, or high redshifts, or metallicity, meaning the abundance of the heavy elements, which is a measure of star formation, much less than what we see locally, then you would expect to see a deuterium plateau. That is, as you go back to systems with less and less stellar evolution, you should find the deuterium abundance flattening out to the primordial value. And I'm going to show you some data of deuterium as a function of metallicity, and well, we'll see what the consequences are. As I already mentioned or showed on the transparency, the deuterium abundance is sensitive to the baryon density. Very good fit to the predicted deuterium abundances that it varies as eta to the minus 1.6 power. That's the good news. The bad news is astronomy is often complicated. Neutral hydrogen and neutral deuterium have the same spectrum except isotope shifted. An isotope shift is like a velocity shift. And so there could be interlopers. That is, there could be small clouds of neutral hydrogen accidentally shifted to the region of where you would expect the deuterium absorption to be. That's one possibility. Another possibility is you're trying to add up all the neutral hydrogen. There's a main absorbing cloud, but there are other small clouds at different velocities, and that might lead you to overestimate the hydrogen where you see the deuterium. Those small clouds may have such little hydrogen that the deuterium associated with it can't be determined. But you're adding in the extra hydrogen, and so your hydrogen column density or amount of hydrogen is inaccurate. So you need to know about velocity structures, some of which you can determine by the heavy element lines, because those are narrow, and if the abundances are high enough, you can identify velocity structure. And as a result, these and some others contribute to systematic uncertainties in the hydrogen column densities in the deuterium. I didn't tell you yet how deuterium is best observed, and I have a transparency that I downloaded, and so the quality isn't so great. But the best way is to look at a distant quasar, which is your background light source at high redshift, and in between the quasar and us, there's an absorbing cloud also at high redshift, so it's early universe. Here's one example of a background quasar where the absorption that's used in this part of the spectrum is at redshift of about 3.6. This is Lyman-Alphen emission from the quasar, And this is all the intervening absorption, mostly hydrogen. This is the so-called Lyman alpha forest. So you're looking at absorption, and the strongest absorption from neutral hydrogen is the Lyman alpha emission, and all of these lines, essentially all of them, constitute what's known as the Lyman alpha forest. You blow up a part of the spectrum, and this is what you see. There's so much hydrogen in this system that you take out all the photons over a significant wavelength range. That makes it hard to determine how much total hydrogen there is. You have to fit a profile, and from the wings of the profile, you estimate the total hydrogen column density. Notice that the fit in the wings isn't very good, and so small H1 clouds may contribute to this extra absorption, making your H1 column density uncertain. But what's nice about this is that the isotope shifted wavelength, where you expect deuterium, instead of the left side of the spectrum looking symmetric with the right side, there's extra absorption, which you attribute to deuterium. So this basically is what is done both in the interstellar medium of our own galaxy and in these QSO absorption systems. So
the QSO is very hard. You might hope that a lot of things would average out, right? The doctor checked, you said the velocity of the cloud.
Well, you see, these clouds are all independent. They have nothing to do with the quasar. They're very far away from the quasar.
In between, they could average.
Maybe not. Well, I don't know if they can average out, in the sense that some of these strong absorption clouds may have halos around them of weaker absorption systems, and they may differ from system to system. So if what you're saying is a large data set would tend to show what the mean is and then the dispersion about the mean, I fully agree with you. Our large data set at the present time is 4.
Oh.
I'll show you that. Yeah.
For that saturated system, do you actually see Lyman beta already?
Yes. No. In fact, what they do is they go up the Lyman series, and usually they get to Lyman 17, 18, 20, and so they use as many of these as they can to try to beat down some of those uncertainties. So, in principle, this is what you do. The blue band is a blow-up of that blue band from my overall summary of the BBN predictions. So here's over a limited range, 1 to 10 in eta. Here is the prediction, the blue band. Suppose I determine by the red band from these QSO absorption spectra what I think the primordial abundance is, then I can determine the baryon density. Of course, we don't just rule lines on this. We do it a little bit more sophisticatedly, but that's the general idea. Here's the situation, and this is why I want to concentrate on deuterium. After several false starts using the Keck telescope, which is ideal for this, it's first of all very difficult to find these systems, because most of these absorption systems are complicated. Once it's complicated, that is many velocity components, you're dead in the water if you want to extract the deuterium abundance. So you have to reject most of them. And in fact, they have to look through hundreds of these spectra before they find what they think is a clean system, clean enough to determine the deuterium abundance. There were several false starts, where it turned out when they looked more closely, there were these extra velocity components complicating the analysis. So I think 1998, with the work of Burleson Teitler at UCSD using the Keck, the first reliable determinations were made for the deuterium abundance. I'm plotting it as a function of metallicity. What was convenient to measure was the silicon abundance. This is a logarithmic scale where 0 is supposed to be the solar silicon abundance, a tenth, a hundredth, a thousandth. So at very low metallicity, when roughly speaking only a thousandth of the silicon that we see today was made, the deuterium abundance is somewhere above 3 to 4 parts in 10 to the 5. That was very nice. Two data points, and they're in reasonable agreement. Most people said, okay, the deuterium abundance has been determined, and therefore we know the baryon density of the universe. Some people said it would be useful to get more data. Beware of what you wish for. The same group, Kirkman et al., but Teitler's group at San Diego, got a third quasar, slightly more metal rich. Remember, here is the interstellar medium abundance, the solar system abundance. You'd expect some variation and then a plateau. Well, it doesn't look like a plateau to me. It looks like it could be increasing, and maybe we haven't reached the plateau yet. Maybe the plateau is higher. In any case, it's clear that this more recent data point is not in very good agreement with the two earlier ones. And Kirkman et al. Realized this, and they didn't argue for a variation, but they suggested that maybe their error bars had been underestimated, and they increased them and took a mean with somewhat larger uncertainties.
Why is it your other argument about, since there's some silicon here, then there's some processing, so why can't some of the deuterium be burned off?
That's perfectly fine. And I think very few people wanted to make that interpretation, because you would expect, in order to destroy deuterium, say, by even a small factor, 25%, you have to cycle 25% of the material through stars. That would increase the metallicity much more than just to a hundredth of solar. So we had to wait for more, and there was another determination, actually from HST, from the Hubble Space Telescope. So a somewhat smaller redshift system, which required that you look into the ultraviolet rather than the optical part of the spectrum. This was done by Max Bettini and Bowen. And so late 2001, here is the newest point. And it's not really consistent with any. In fact, it's consistent with no evolution at all from the early universe up to the solar system. Because it was a space telescope, and because they didn't get all the data they wanted, there are uncertainties associated with understanding the velocity structure very well. They believe they have accounted for those uncertainties with the size of their error bar. But what I want to point out is that this is the status as of the end of 2001, around 2002. There are four data points, and they're not in very good agreement with each other. Now, I mentioned what might be some of the sources of systematic uncertainties, these interlopers. And so let me show the same data plotted as, not as a function of metallicity, but as the hydrogen column density. So these two absorbers have high hydrogen column density. Now, if the hydrogen column density estimate, which is determined by the wings of the absorption feature, is contaminated by smaller clouds of hydrogen which absorb some of those photons in the wings, maybe you've overestimated the hydrogen column density and therefore underestimated the deuterium abundance. So these points may come up. These are the so-called damp Lyman alpha absorbers. These are what are called Lyman limit systems, lower hydrogen column densities. Maybe these are affected by an interloper contributing to the deuterium absorption. Because as you go to lower and lower hydrogen column densities, there are more and more such clouds. Now, a cloud which is at the level of, say, 10 to the minus 5 of a total column density of 10 to the 17 to 10 to the 18, that would have no effect here, but could contribute to the deuterium here, so maybe these points would move down. So it's my point of view that the current situation is not straightforward. It's unclear, I think. And to say that the deuterium abundance is known, I think, is perhaps wishful thinking. I think we need more systems. Easy enough for a theorist to tell the observers, go and find me more systems. But from the Sloan Sky Survey, there are many more quasars that are being studied, which could provide absorption systems that could be used for this. So what I'm going to do in the following, but I say it with large caveats based on what I've just described to you, is I'll do what Kirkman et al. Did. I'm going to inflate the error bars so that the reduced chi-squared is about 1 per degree of freedom. I have no good justification for this, and in fact, Teitler and his colleagues are currently reanalyzing actually their three data points to try to identify systematic errors that they may have missed previously, and perhaps in the next few months or within the next year, some or all of these points may change one way or the other. Nonetheless, what I have done is I've taken a weighted average for the deuterium abundance, and I've taken an uncertainty which reflects these expanded error bars. That enables me to get a determination. Actually, let me point out, even by doing this, I have, roughly speaking, a 14% uncertainty in the deuterium abundance. Because the deuterium abundance depends upon the baryon density to the 1.6 power, that corresponds to about a 9% uncertainty in the baryon density. And that's shown here. That is, if I had stopped at 1998, when there were two systems, I would have found omega BH squared of about 0.019, with the error bar indicated here. Early 2001, late 2001, omega BH squared increased from about 0.019 to about a little bit above 0.02 to 0.022. And now I've just inflated the error bars. This is what you would do naively, but you'd have a terrible chi-squared. Here I've inflated the error bars, and that's what I'll use for the baryon density. Before I comment on the consequences for number of neutrinos, let me just point out what I think is the most interesting consequence. That is, here is that omega BH squared that I showed you, but plotted as omega versus the Hubble parameter. The current value is probably about 72 plus or minus 8 or so, so right in the middle of this diagram. Here's what you predict from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. About 4% of the critical density is in baryons. What you see in the universe from things that shine or absorb is something that is less than a part in 100 of the critical density. This is from the work of Peebles and Hogan and Fukugita and others before them to try to estimate the density in stuff that you see shining or absorbing. The gap shows that most of the baryons in the present universe are dark. However, I showed you a spectrum that showed this Lyman alpha forest at redshifts less than 3. If you add up all the baryons in the Lyman alpha forest at about redshift of 2 or so, you actually come very close to the nucleosynthesis bound. So it's not that those baryons aren't there. Somehow they've conspired to become dark between a redshift 2 and the present epoch. The other gap, here we have an estimate of the total matter density. That is, the total density today in non-relativistic matter, as evidenced by the motions of galaxies in clusters, binary galaxies, groups of galaxies, gravitational lensing, somewhere around 30% of the critical density with a pretty large uncertainty, nonetheless a big gap that shows that most of the matter in the universe is non-baryonic. And the gap, of course, from here up to 100% is what is supposed to be provided by some mysterious form of dark energy, about which I won't have anything to say today. Okay, back to nucleosynthesis. I think I know the deuterium abundance. I can predict the helium abundance, and I can compare. So here for the standard case, the n nu equals 3 curve, 3 neutrinos, this is what I would expect for the helium mass fraction as a function of the deuterium abundance. Here's the data point. And now it's a matter of whether you like your glass half full or half empty. The difference is only about 2 sigma, a little bit less than 2 sigma. So some might say this is excellent agreement. I haven't told you, mainly because of time, about the complications for determining the primordial helium abundance. Again, I'd be glad to talk at length about that. And in fact, there was a paper on the net yesterday. I've only absorbed the abstract. I want to see more about it. All of the helium abundance determinations, and in particular this vertical bar here, are from observing helium and emission in H2 regions, regions of hot ionized gas. So you look at the recombination from ionized to neutral helium, even from doubly ionized to singly ionized helium. You compare that to the recombinations of hydrogen, and you determine the helium abundance in systems of relatively low metallicity, not a hundredth of solar, but maybe a 30th, a 40th, a 50th of solar. There are many possible systematic errors there, and in fact, two different determinations from of order 40 of these H2 regions each differ by more than their quoted statistical errors. And there are good reasons to believe that there are systematic uncertainties dominating that determination. What's nice about this paper that appeared on AstroPH yesterday is that it uses a method that employs stars, old stars and globular clusters, so metal poor and maybe close to primordial, in helium abundance at least. Now this is an old method, and among the reasons that it hasn't been useful in the past is that there are many stellar evolution uncertainties. The authors claim they've dealt with those, and we'll see, I think, how that stands up to scrutiny. It gives a slightly higher value about here with an error bar that's a little bit bigger than these error bars. So consistent with what I've shown you here, but a little bit higher. So again, not in excellent agreement with the prediction, but not bad either. Now, I mentioned lithium, and I'm not going to spend any more time on it, but I do want to show you the same kind of plot for lithium predicted as a function of deuterium predicted. This is the BBN band, bigger uncertainties. There were observations by Ryan, Beers, and Norris, maybe not in that order, of a sample of low metallicity stars in the halo of our galaxy, where they determined the lithium abundance. And then this analysis, which involved Keith Olive and Brian Fields as well, tried to account for that abundance by also adding in a component from early cosmic ray nucleosynthesis, which would reduce the primordial value because some of the lithium came from another process. This is their data point, and as you can see, it's very far away from the prediction. With my colleagues at Ohio State, Mark Pinsino, who's the expert on stars, and in particular rotating stars, which can mix material from the surface into the interior, and Terry Walker and a student of Mark's, Narayanan, we determined that it could not be excluded that these early stars, these very old stars in the galaxy, had actually mixed some of the lithium from the surface into the interior and destroyed it. Using their data, along with Mark's stellar models for rotating stars, we believe this data point should be up here, and of course with considerably larger error bars. So again, there may or may not be a lithium problem, in the sense that for the deuterium abundance, we've determined the predicted lithium abundance seems to be higher than what we observe at the present. But let me put that aside, except maybe for a comment later, and go back to just helium and deuterium. Do they agree or not? If I assume those error bars that I showed you were Gaussian distributed, then here are the likelihood distributions in the upper panel for the standard model for the baryon density determined by helium. Helium prefers a low baryon density. Deuterium prefers a high baryon density. The overlap is at about the 4% level. So not good, but not terrible. Another way of visualizing the exact same thing is to show you a figure I've showed you before, allowing for non-standard physics. Here's the data point, and it's closer to the two neutrino case than it is to the three neutrino case. Again, it only differs by less than 2 sigma. Nonetheless, it's some hint that maybe the early universe expanded more slowly, had a lower relativistic density than the standard model. Now, of course, if it's neutrinos, we know we have to start at 3. However, there are models based on higher dimensional physics, in particular Randall-Sundrum type cosmology, in which there's an additional term in the Hubble equation, the Friedman equation. That is, the Hubble parameter has the usual density terms, and it has an extra term that looks like a relativistic energy density term. That is, it redshifts as 1 plus z to the fourth. But it has a coefficient that could be negative. And so I won't take that as evidence for this higher dimensional theory, but I want you to keep in mind that a result like this isn't necessarily nonsense. It could be an indication of some new physics, which is, after all...
Yeah, I heard you say that it's 2 sigma from the 2 neutrino case.
From the 3 neutrino
case.
From
the 3 neutrino.
Yeah.
How many sigma from the 2 neutrino?
Oh, less than 1.
So it's 2 sigma...
Well, I'll quote you some numbers.
Oh, so...
But I wanted to show pictures, but I will at the end in a summary show you what the formal numbers are. But those formal numbers can be deceiving, because I think systematic errors likely dominate over statistical.
Is there a value for the deuterium abundance which makes it consistent? You had 4 data points. Is there any amount of consistency?
Well, what you can see is much easier to increase the helium abundance to get agreement than it is to move the deuterium abundance all the way over here. So no, there are none of those. You would need something in excess of 10 parts in 10 to the 5. And remember, all those data points were between about 2 and 4. So unless there's something really wrong, that is very strong evolution of deuterium, it's very hard to just change the deuterium abundance. Much easier to play with the helium abundance. Okay, if I think I know the region of parameter space that's interesting, it turns out that it's relatively easy to extend the standard model, which has 1 free parameter, the baryon density, to a 2-parameter case. Let me keep as a free parameter the speed up in the expansion rate and the baryon density, and let me limit myself to small ranges. Then this approximation shown on this transparency is actually very good. I'm showing you isoabundance curves, and let me explain. The vertical axis is the speed up factor, so 1 is the standard model, versus the baryon density. And over a range which is small but not at all negligible, 4 to 7 in eta sub 10, 80% to 110% of the standard expansion rate in the speed up factor. This is the isoabundance contour for 25% helium, 24%, 23%. So what you see is the helium abundance is most sensitive to the speed up. The dashed curves are for the deuterium abundance, 4 parts in 10 to the 5, 3 parts in 10 to the 5, 2.5 and 2.0. That's most sensitive to the extent that it's more nearly vertical, to the baryon density. Here in this plane is the data with the error bars. And once again, what you see, another way of saying it, is that the solution favors a slower than standard expansion. Now, let me show you the same transparency, but with yet another set of curves to make life even more complicated, but it's for the lithium abundance. Notice that, so the green dotted curves are for a lithium abundance of 3.3 parts in 10 to the 10, 4.1 part in 10 to the 10, 5 parts in 10 to the 10. What you see is that unless there's something dramatically wrong with the baryon density inferred from deuterium mainly, the lithium abundance should be high, between say 3 and 5 parts in 10 to the 10. Very far from about the 1 part in 10 to the 10 value of Ryan, Norris, and Beers. And in fact, to try to show that, I have a transparency from work in progress from David Lambert and Vern Smith in Texas. This is some of their data as well as other data. Here's the lithium abundance on a logarithmic scale. Sorry for that, but that's what astronomers do. So, for example, around here, 2.1 to 2.2 on this log scale means 1 to 2 parts in 10 to the 10. This is what the data seems to be saying without a correction for lithium depletion, whereas 4 parts in 10 to the 10 would be 2.6, would be up here. So there may be a problem with lithium, which can't be resolved by changing the expansion rate of the universe. If this problem persists, then maybe it's the nuclear physics that should be looked at again. So let me give you a summary as of the end of the past year or the beginning of this year. With the data at hand, only 4 absorption line systems, the deuterium abundance is known to about 14%. That leads to a baryon density, or mega BH squared, about 0.022, with about a 9% uncertainty. The predicted helium abundance is 0.248, 24.8% of the mass in baryons is in helium, with a very small uncertainty, because the predicted helium abundance is insensitive to the baryon density and only is really determined by the uncertainty in the neutron lifetime. So there's a very small uncertainty. The lithium abundance is about 4 parts in 10 to the 10. The helium abundance that I adopted was 23.8% with an error plus or minus 0.005. So formally, the preferred value of the speed-up factor is 94% of the standard value, or delta N nu is minus 0.7. And what I mean by this is that even if you adopt these non-standard values now, you still get a lithium abundance of about 4 parts in 10 to the 10. Apparently higher without correction for stellar destruction than what's seen. Let me very quickly show you what happens now if we try to determine the baryon density from the CMB anisotropy spectrum. But we're also going to allow non-standard energy density in the relativistic particles. So we're going to assume that N nu equals 3 is the base, and we're going to allow extra energy density in relativistic particles. This is from work actually a much larger project with my former student Jim Neller and I. It was on AstroPH a couple of months ago and has been accepted in PhysRevD. We investigated the effect of quintessence and non-minimally coupled fields as well. But one of the cases was the one that I am describing now. Let me just show you, before I show you the CMB results, two ways of showing you what I've been telling you over and over again. The best fit value allowing delta and nu to vary and even be negative versus the baryon density is at a value of eta between 5 and 6 parts in 10 to the 10, and delta and nu about minus 0.7. But you notice that in this two-dimensional plot, already at the 95% contour, positive values of delta and nu are allowed. So maybe there is no problem. On the other hand, if we restrict ourselves to delta and nu being positive, and nu being bigger than or equal to 3, the best fit is actually at a relatively low value of eta. But of course, since we've restricted ourselves to positive values, the 95% and 99% contours are a bit higher. And I'll write down some of those numbers at the very end. But let's do the same thing using the CMB. I don't have time to discuss in any detail the different effects of changing the relativistic energy density and the baryon density. Needless to say, they each affect the positions and the heights of the acoustic peaks in the CMB spectrum. And they're correlated, or actually anti-correlated, slightly anti-correlated, in the sense that a lower baryon density along with a higher energy density in relativistic particles can give you the same fit to the CMB anisotropy spectrum pre-MAP, pre-release of the MAP data. The best fit value is actually for a positive, n nu greater than 3, but as you can see, at better than the 95% value, a zero value is not at all excluded. So this was a flat cosmology. So we analyzed the CMB data assuming flat cosmology, allowing for the for variations in baryon density and in the relativistic energy content.
So you say that the fit with three neutrinos is not good?
The fit with three neutrinos is not preferred by the CMB, and this is actually, this has been known for some time. The likelihood is not terribly bad, but the best fit actually occurs for positive values of delta and nu. We'll see what Planck has to say, what MAP has to say about this. One of the things, but I think it's a small effect, is that once you allow the relativistic energy density to change, you change the early expansion rate of the universe. And therefore, imposing the requirement that the universe is flat restricts some of your choices. Because we think the universe is flat because we use the standard relativistic energy density. But there's a trade-off between flatness and the relativistic energy density, but I think that's a higher order effect. I don't think that will change things very much.
What CMB data? Because, I mean, I'm surprised. The CMB data.
Boomerang.
A lot of errors.
Yeah, no, it was Boomerang, Maxima, Daisy, basically most of the data before Akbar and Akiops and... I think this is preliminary in the sense that MAP will supersede this very quickly, but I'd like to show you what the effect is of combining BBN and the CMB. And this, with current data, this hasn't been done before, and I think it should be kept in mind in analyzing the future data. Often people take a prior in the CMB analysis based on what they think BBN has told them. I think by doing these independently, there's going to be much more to be learned, or at least I think it'll be more robust. So here are the again on the same scale, because I had shown you a blown-up version of this scale for the BBN results. Here is the CMB constraint and the BBN constraint. And you'll notice that at the favorite BBN point, the overlap with the CMB is not terribly good. And in fact, when you do a joint analysis, you actually find a somewhat higher than either of these best fit points for eta. Now the best fit point is essentially at delta N nu is zero. That is, the BBN prefers low delta N nu, even really prefers negative delta N nu, whereas the CMB slightly prefers high delta N nu. When you do a joint analysis, the best fit point is actually very close to delta N nu equals zero, and delta N equals zero is perfectly allowed.
This analysis assumes delta N nu is positive?
Right. Yes, this analysis assumed delta N nu is positive. Okay, well.
What if you don't assume that?
If you don't assume that, I don't know if I know I don't have a transparency to show it. Basically, delta N nu equals zero is the best fit point. Yeah. You don't move down very much.
But what's the goodness of fit of the joint?
The goodness of fit is actually quite good. I don't have the numbers in my head. It's in our paper. But the goodness of fit is actually quite good.
But how can it be? It's off by 2 sigma in both cases, your joint point.
Let me see if I can find the goodness of fit then, what we said. We got a chi-squared of 47 for 39 degrees of freedom.
For the joint analysis.
For the joint analysis.
And delta N nu greater than zero.
Well, delta N nu was actually about 0.1.
It required to be greater than zero.
Yes, delta N nu required to be greater than zero. Greater than or equal to zero. I was going to, given Yvonne's beautiful talk yesterday about neutrino asymmetry, I was going to say that instead of allowing the expansion factor S to be different from 1, or the relativistic energy content to be different from 1, you could do the same thing, you could achieve the same thing by a slight electron neutrino asymmetry. Let me just show the result before I show you the conclusions, because I've run over time. So here's the same kind of plot, but instead of my extra parameter being the expansion rate, it's this electron neutrino asymmetry parameter, mu over kT, more electron neutrinos than antineutrinos, which will drive the neutron to proton ratio down. So again, in this plot, the blue lines are the isoabundance contours for deuterium, the red for helium-4. The deuterium contours are very nearly vertical on this diagram. And what you see is that you could accomplish the very same thing without changing the expansion rate of the universe if you have an electron neutrino asymmetry of about 0.03. Even if nu mu and nu tau have the same asymmetries, the change in the expansion rate is negligible. And so you could accomplish the same thing by a slight neutrino asymmetry, not that I'm pushing it, but that it can't be excluded either. Okay, so let me summarize what I think that was to show you for more sophisticated models, and I could show you that if you're interested. Okay. So for the case of no asymmetry in the neutrinos, and N nu 3 or greater, the best joint fit with BBN and the CMB is at omega BH squared of 0.024. or an eta value of about 6.6. It turns out that there have been, in the last few months, there have been some analyses of the joint analyses of the CMB data along with large-scale structure from the Sloan or the 2DF surveys. Several different groups have done this, Percival et al., Bond et al., and Tegmark and his friends. And it turns out that, at least from the Tegmark analysis, the value they prefer for this joint analysis that has nothing to do with BBN is 0.024. But we'll see what MAP has to say about this. At 99% confidence, the upper bound from this joint fit to delta N nu, allowing N nu to be only 3 or greater, is a little bit above 1. Delta N nu is acceptable at better than the 95% confidence level, and I think I went a bit overboard here. The lithium abundance is bigger than about 4 parts in 10 to the 10. Or you can allow the neutrino symmetry to be broken with a small degeneracy parameter. Again, the best fit value is for omega BH squared about 0.024. The best fit value for Xi is about 0.03, but again, at better than 95%, Xi equals 0 is also acceptable, but once again, a high lithium abundance. So I think it's clear that in the pre-MAP era, we're led to a relatively high baryon density, 6 parts in 10 to the 10, or maybe a little bit greater, omega BH squared, 0.022, or maybe 0.024. There is some tension between deuterium and helium, and between deuterium and lithium, which may have nothing to do with interesting physics. It may be interesting astrophysics. It may be that there are systematic effects in the observational data or in the interpretation of the data that will resolve these apparent discrepancies. Or they could be pointing the way towards some interesting new physics. Thanks.
You adopted the 0.238 plus or minus 0.005 so-called compromise value
for the
helium abundance, I noticed. And I guess one could raise a question about whether that's really justified, given that different analyses which differ on the basis of systematic effects are not consistent with each other from a statistical point of view. So I was wondering what your attitude was to perhaps doing the analyses assuming various different groups, extractions of the helium abundance,
and you know. Well, the Isotov and Tuan data set, which is the largest, most homogeneous data set, their analysis of it gives a helium abundance. Maybe it'd be useful to write these numbers. Well, I'll say the numbers. We used, as Ray points out, I used 23.8 plus or minus 0.5% helium abundance. Isotov and Tuan would have 24.4 plus or minus about 0.2. The 2 sigma upper bounds in both cases are 24.8%, which is the BBN preferred value. So in some sense, using the 2, you get agreement at roughly the 2 sigma level. Now, certainly the 0.05 is not a real sigma, because as you say, it was a compromise between earlier work that I'd done with Keith Olive and Evan Skillman on a heterogeneous set of H2 regions where we found 23.4% with an uncertainty of about 0.003. Clearly inconsistent with 24.4 plus or minus 0.02. So taking this average may not be the sensible thing to do, which was the reason we expanded the error bars to 0.005, which we thought was an estimate of some of the systematic effects. What my colleagues and I have done subsequently, that is in the last few years, is to look carefully at some of these possible systematic effects. And for example, you don't see neutral helium and you don't see neutral hydrogen. So you have to make an ionization correction. Isotov and Tuan make no ionization correction. That is, they say where the hydrogen is ionized, so is the helium. Now you might think, well, wait a second, I know the helium ionization potential is considerably higher than that for hydrogen, so maybe there's neutral helium where there's hydrogen. Therefore, the helium abundance should actually be higher than I thought. On the other hand, if the ionizing spectrum is very hard, you can actually invert it, and you can have ionized helium where the hydrogen has become neutral. So my colleagues and I have used codes that analyze ionized H2 regions, and using various spectra have tried to estimate this effect. We find that it's likely to go in the sense of reducing the Isotov and Tuon helium abundance. Yadamczyk and Zauer also did the same thing, finding similar results. Manuel Painbert and collaborators believe that H2 regions aren't homogeneous in temperature, that there are temperature fluctuations. They have reanalyzed four of the Isotov and Tuon H2 regions, accounting for what they think are the temperature variations, reducing their values by about 0.007 or so. So not all the systematic effects have been investigated, but so far they're going in the direction of reducing the Isotov and Tuon value. Now there's one serious one that hasn't been quantitatively accounted for, which actually goes the other way. And that is, you're seeing these helium emission lines on top of the stellar absorption lines from the stars that are ionizing the region. Those stars are very hot. They have absorption lines at the same place, but much broader, than where the helium is being built, the emission is being built. So if you thought the emission was on top of a flat continuum, and really it was on top of a trough, there's more helium than you accounted for. And people are aware of this, but nobody has done a systematic analysis of using a series of helium lines to try to account for this underlying absorption, which could go in the opposite direction. Yes?
Now, going back to the CMP constraints, did you include effects of reionization?
No.
That could make a big difference.
Basically, it's the first two peaks or the first three peaks that are most affected. And so I think it could make an effect. I mean, there's a lot we didn't account for. Tegmark and friends do a 12-parameter analysis. We basically did a 4-parameter analysis. But our final constraint on nu was dominated by the BBN constraint. So I don't think our constraint on nu is... The CMB, actually, in an earlier analysis, we and others had made a similar plot of delta nu versus eta from the CMB. And by allowing more parameters, not reionization even then, we actually got much larger contours, that is going to much higher values of delta nu. And Hanestad and others all did similar work, and we all found similar conclusions that the best fit value wasn't at nu equals 3. On the other hand, we weren't terribly far away from nu equals 3 either.
The bottom more like 15, right?
That's right. That's right. It's very shallow. So that's why I don't want to say very much about the CMB now, because it's all going to change with MAP. So we were very crude in this analysis, realizing that the strongest constraint on delta nu would come from the BBN, whereas a good constraint on eta would come from the CMB. Yeah?
So when will we hear from MAP?
Anybody know? All I heard was it was up to NASA. I don't know that MAP is having any problem in their analysis. I think they're ready to announce. And the last I had heard was that NASA decides when's a good time for a press conference, and maybe not when we're invading Iraq or something. So I actually don't know, and I don't know if anyone here has any inside information on that. I mean, it was anticipated that they might announce at the AAS meeting in early January, and they didn't.
So you said you varied 4 parameters. I guess it was omega lambda, omega matter, omega baryon, and number neutrinos.
Good question. For BBN and for some of the of what's important for the CMB, the only parameters of interest are the baryon density and the relativistic energy density, delta and nu. Lambda in the early evolution of the universe is totally negligible. However, if you're analyzing the CMB data, it is very important. And of course, the best fit values require that omega lambda is about twice omega matter. So in fact, in our CMB analysis, we did allow lambda to vary, but it has no effect on the BBN bounds. But we impose flatness, so you allow omega lambda to value that tells you to vary. That tells you how omega matters vary.
People used to look at large inhomogeneities in the early universe, and they don't do that anymore. We have small inhomogeneities. Would that help with the lithium problem?
I think not. And one of the reasons that people no longer look at the inhomogeneous models is largely because of the valley shape for the lithium production. You get lithium produced at low density, and you get lithium produced at high density. And as a result, all of those inhomogeneous models overproduce the lithium abundance. So you make it even worse than what may or may not be a problem today.
Mm-hmm.